In tech we trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
Hey everybody, welcome to In Tech We Trust, episode 91 on June 21st, 2016. This is the longest day, the shortest night of the year. Hey now!
Yeah.
Yeah, and today, on today's show, we have El Rigatron.
I'm back!
He's back. He's nice to have you back.
Thanks, guys. It's, you know, to the world, the joke is real. El Rigatron does indeed travel with the Windows Surface RT tablet, which we've migrated to the recording platform that we're using now. I can't use it on there, so dum-da-da-dum-dum. I'm sorry. I'll get that fixed, and I won't be missing as much.
Yeah, we had to give you some grief over that, Rick. And but before we do too much of that, we have Yadine Porter de Leon.
Yay!
Oh, nice. This is my second episode recording, and the first one when I got introduced, wait, I didn't get the Mark Farley drum roll. So this is the first show that I'm doing with you, Mark, even though I did a Ridecast with you, and then you, Rick, as well. And so, and I did a horrible job too, like pimping my the other stuff that I do out on the last episode. I was very reserved. I was like, I was just hanging back.
You weren't pimpin-ish enough?
Yeah, no, I know. I didn't pimp anything out that I did.
You gotta be pimpin-ish.
Yeah, yeah. So I could pimp out the other podcast that I have, which is called the SockNet Podcast. So I'm a host on that show. I think that's how you found me, Mark.
Well, yeah, I've been watching you. I've kept my eyes on you for a while on the socials.
Yeah, socially stalking me.
Socially stalking you, yeah.
Or at least stalking our podcast Twitter account. He's like, you're one of the most active engagers, so that'll get you a mention or something.
That's true. Yeah, you actually were paying attention to our podcast, Yadine. So, you know, that happens, folks out there. If you pay enough attention to our podcast, you might even come on as a guest even sometime, or maybe even as a host. I never know.
Hey, maybe you could even pay the bill. Who knows?
Hey, now. Yeah. Oh, yeah, Yadine, we've been meaning to talk to you about something else. So, Rigatron, where have you been?
Oh, goodness, where have I been not? Oh, I am going way back. I got to admit, guys, the last 2 months have been the most difficult travel schedule I've ever had. Are you ready? Fasten your seatbelts. Here we go.
Okay, here we go.
May and June, I have been to Ohio, to Las Vegas, and back. I did a dirty day trip, which is fly out early, red eye back. Then I went to South Africa. Then I was in Romania. Then I was home. Then I went to London for a week. And no joke, on Friday, I flew home to Ohio. Then on Saturday, fly to Dublin, Ireland for vacation. I'm not making this up.
What?
I'm making it up.
Dublin,
Ireland.
Did you get to the Guinness store?
Oh yeah, yeah. We did it all. We killed that country. It was awesome. My wife and I, it was a vacation. A lot of people are like, well, why don't you just fly from London to Dublin and have the wife meet you there? And it was one of those things of, so you want me to pack up the kids and drive them 2 hours to my mom and drive an hour to the airport and fly across the world? And
then
she starts to scream, by myself? And I'm like, no, sure, I'll come home and help. So two transatlantic flights in 2 days. That's what I do. Next week, I'm in Napa, and that should conclude 2 weeks of intense travel, but oh my goodness, has it hurt.
What are you doing in Napa?
Stuff.
Work stuff?
Yeah, stuff.
You doing winery stuff? Winery work stuff?
Yeah, stuff.
I'm trying to remember.
No.
Was I there?
No, we've got it's a Veeam event, a little bit of something going on.
I was going to say, I'd drive up and drink some wine with you or something.
I might have a whole.
It sounds like a secret event.
Well, it's not secret. It's like it's an exclusive situation, but I might have a hole in the agenda. I may bug you.
You know what I think he's doing, Yadine? I think he's going mud spying. I think he's going to lie down in the hot mud and get caked up there in like Calistoga. Right?
My wife convinced me to do that. I can't do that again. I got in there once.
And the mud got into, and the mud get into places it couldn't get out?
It goes everywhere.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
Mud.
I hate when that happens. Well, that's probably too much information. We should get on to the show, huh?
Please.
So, okay, yeah. So the agenda for this week, DockerCon. So Nigel's up at DockerCon, and he's covering it with separate on-site DockerCon podcast for In Tech We Trust. So one of those is already up. It went up yesterday. He'll do another one. Yeah, but we have to talk about it here, too.
I think he's embedded. Like, you know, you get embedded with the platoon or something. He's embedded with, I think it's the Geek Whisperers or something.
I believe he is. And in fact, I know something about that, but I can't say because, like, I'm not embedded, but I'm entrusted to an embedded guy.
Ah.
That sounds wrong. Well, I didn't say that.
It's way cleaner to be embedded than in bed. So, you know.
True. True that. So one thing that goes along with that, though, is this is the fact that Docker is saying, you know, trying to position themselves away from VMs, which is kind of interesting. And so they've had some discussion about that. We'll talk a little bit about that here. China apparently has built the blazing list fastest supercomputer. HPC goes to China. Who knows when we'll get it back? Did it really happen? Can we prove it? What's going on there? We'll talk about that. And then there was somebody created this app, mobile app, so you could supposedly see immigrants or migrants in the Mediterranean Sea, and you could supposedly spot them in real time. The only problem is they weren't actually showing real migrants in real time. And so we'll talk about, well, I don't know how much we'll talk about it, but we'll ask questions around in that. I mean, like, what the hell? And then we're going to have business news. Oracle, what's happening with Oracle, their numbers. Dell selling off their enterprise software business. I did a little broadcast with Chris Evans about that yesterday, but we'll talk about it again. And then mayors around the globe at major cities are trying to solve their biggest problems, which apparently are Uber and Airbnb. And then what's going on in the market for exits of startups, right? Who's buying them? Who's not buying them? And who's waiting on the sidelines? It looks like some of the large acquirers that are left would prefer to go bargain hunting than to try to buy something at a high valuation. Go figure. Even companies like to save money. And finally, we're going to hit on Twitter investing in something, Twitter investing in SoundCloud. You know, go figure. We'll talk about that too. All right. You guys ready to go?
Let's go.
Let's do this.
Okay. So DockerCon's going on. People are paying attention. They've got a new release, Docker Engine 1.12. Apparently, it's got a new cluster mode and all kinds of new orchestration stuff. But to me, the bigger thing around DockerCon is just the excitement of DockerCon itself. This feels a lot like new technologies do when they're getting their legs and they're just getting off the ground and they're getting ready to sprint. You know, there's been a lot of doubts, you know, expressed in the past about Docker. Does it have a way to monetize? Is it going to make money? But to me, this seems like one of those phenomenons. What are you guys seeing?
Well, I think it's real. I think that, you know, Nigel's going to be our pulse, right, from the event. And I definitely look to him for, you know, outstanding perspective on this. But the thing is, there is that fresh buzz that comes from the new ecosystem that's developing, and it's exciting, right? Sure, they've got big sponsors. You know, I've poked through the webpage, like Microsoft is their biggest sponsor. Interesting, eh? But beyond that, those are big companies in addition, like Cisco and IBM are also sponsoring. But there's a lot of people, a lot of Twitter news, a lot of videos are there, and it is right now the place to be. In fact, I think that it's a lot more exciting, right, than probably other events that are going on, because they don't have any perceptions or targets and rules right now. So it's forming. So there's a lot of fun. I think it's real. It's going to stick. And, you know, I think there's an opportunity. People do better things in their data center with these technologies.
Yeah, I was watching Brian and John on the Cube, and they were talking about how the buzz was really reminding them of the early days of VMware. And that was a theme that I was starting to see throughout the Twitter posts, in the podcast that Nigel was recording with some of the people that were on site. And everyone was really excited just about the volume of people and the news that was coming out and the vendors that were there. And so, yeah, that excitement is definitely very palpable. And I think, like I'd mentioned, you know, the fact that, you know, Amy Lewis is on theCUBE with Brian and John means that this containers thing is like a thing now.
Yeah, it would seem to be. I mean, Amy's there. So what's the other conference that's going on right now? Is it Nutanix Next?
Dot Next.
I mean, what's interesting about that is a year ago, that might have been a really big deal. But except for people from Nutanix and the people that are there supporting that show, does anybody else give a rip?
I'll play the other side on this. You know, personal opinions aside, Nutanix people are very loyal. to them. They have a very strong following, and this is their second occurrence of the event. So, you know, they are doing something, and it's a lot of work to put on an event as a I'd actually challenge that it's a lot different than DockerCon, because the notion of containers are very much a broader technology that honestly, you know, isn't explicitly Docker. But Nutanix.next is explicitly their, you know, kit and software, right? So there's a lot more of a closed view to this other side. And you can't even compare the buzz in the community right now. But, you know, it is a thing, but it's a different thing.
Yeah, I saw a tweet on it this morning where somebody said, it looks like these conferences are taking place 5 years apart, even though they're at the same time.
I mean, it goes back to the fundamental thought on the religious issue of where one is on hyperconvergence, right? Because where's another person on containerized apps? Those are like religious issues in the IT community.
So it's funny. I had a conversation actually with one of my one of the leader in the marketing team, and I was kind of bantering about with this. But a lot of people started to use this term convergent, hyperconverged, and it started to be used like across like everyone from software to hardware to services. But it seems like it's starting to coalesce around these hardware vendors like Nutanix. And maybe you could just give me a quick sort of opinion on the word, that converged piece. Is that just the hardware guys that kind of own that term now? I know it's just being overused everywhere.
Well, my angle is, when I say hyperconvergence, I'm referring to the Nutanixes, the Simplivities, the Maxtas, the Scales. If I were to use the word hypervisor convergence, I'm referring to something like what VMware vSAN are doing and the like. But pick your poison, choose your word, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, when I hear it, my first reaction is to think about hardware.
Yeah, you know. I don't want to go too deep down this, because I know it's been well-trodden territory, the whole hyperconverged conversation. But I feel like that it's gotten kind of boiled down to really just a lot of the hardware pieces and not so much the software, even though people are still using it in the whole software ecosystem.
Yeah. Hey, so let's talk a little bit about Docker. And speaking of hyperconvergence and whether or not Docker has a role in it or not, you know, they're trying to position themselves away from VMware, or at least it seems like that. Rick, you did some looking into this. What's your opinion?
Well, here's my fundamental thing that I've always said about any new application or infrastructure technology. If it is going to be doing important things, it needs to have protection and management. And a lot of times people are coming back with me with like, well, it's so stateless, you don't need that. But you know what? Have you ever worked in a bank, right? And things like forensic logging is actually very important for controls reasons. If somebody needed to know what happened with a piece of data as it moved through a workflow, you know, that's where I like the idea of having them as a VM, because you can protect and manage them at a different level and honestly completely out of band from whatever is going on in this ecosystem, whether it be, you know, containers on Nano server with Windows eventually, or the Photon OS approach with VMware. I disagree with that philosophically, just because what if there's some log or something that happened on a container to do whatever it needed to do, and if there's no visibility or a way to protect and manage it, I think that's a risk that, you know, people may not have thought all the way through.
Yeah, I think that not enough people are talking about that. I was actually talking about a compliance risk expert about doing a whole piece on that, and they did a webinar with us. And that's one of the things that seems to be that conversation is starting right now within the container world. But a huge issue is how do you report on the state of your application environment at any given time if you've got this massive amount of containers, things only existing for, let's say, nanoseconds or a few seconds or a few minutes? How do you say what version of your software and what state it was in within, you know, any particular time? And how do you prove that, you know, a certain transaction was done a certain way if you've just got all of these things, you know, and you've got Chaos Monkey, you know, going around taking things down, you know, automatically to test your system at the same time. That all sounds really cool from a developer standpoint. But when you start getting into the nitty-gritty of, well, what do enterprises need to do? What are the requirements? What are they burdened with from a legal standpoint? And you might run into some questions like that within the container space that can't be answered by the current way that the information the containers are managed. And now they talked about orchestration, and maybe you guys can comment a little bit on your perspective on that, but it seems like that's just controlling container sprawl just in the way that VM sprawl needed to be contained. But now we're talking an order of magnitude of 10x to 100x when you talk about containers versus VMs.
The controls, the responsibilities, the occasional audit that might come up, those requirements don't go away if the application changes. So it's just one of those things that, you know, I'm just looking at it that way because I've been through, you know, intense audits down to the log level. Those are things that can come up. And I don't want to be a stick in the mud here, but I'm just saying if you have a platform like a hypervisor, you can really, on scale, collect that stuff pretty easily to help you when that comes up.
And I'll also take the other side of this argument as well, which people come up with, well, the regulation hasn't caught up with the way in which we architect right now, which it hasn't. Because there's going to be ways in which you're going to architect the application where it's going to be in a containerized mode or a microservices mode, or it's going to be, you know, serverless or Jeff or whatever that is. And you're not going to be able to control the state of it or log the state of it every single second. And there's going to be a certain point in which regulations and audits are going to need to catch up with modern architecture. So the other side of that argument is that no, it's not going to be something that that regulation's going to effectively address, but eventually it's going to have to be because that's the way we're going to build our systems.
Yeah, I did a Ridecast yesterday with Chris Evans, and I haven't posted it yet, but Chris was talking about how different people there were trying to address the problems of persistent storage for containers and Docker. And apparently somebody from Joyent was there and they just said, well, all you really need to do is stream to an object store and we'll, you know, just everything that gets updated will store in the object store. That doesn't take care of versions of software and versions of databases and those kinds of things. It's just a dumping ground for transactions, but I'm not sure how even fast that can be. So, I'll have to post that thing and make it available So people can hear what Chris has to say about it. He's always got interesting insights.
But yeah, the way we're set up now, though, there's no way to really open up the hood and say this is what was going on at that exact time and prove it from, you know, defensibility standpoint.
Hey, let's move over to China. Speaking of defensibility standpoints, China just built the biggest supercomputer, the fastest supercomputer. Is that true?
Yeah, 10.65 million computer cores. But the cool thing was that it was built entirely from Chinese microprocessors. No U.S. Made in China, 100%.
Whose design?
Oh, that's interesting. The system's called the Shenwei Tiahu Lite, which is funny. That's the Tiahu Lite. Like, it's the biggest supercomputer in the world, and they call it Lite. So when the full version comes out, it's going to be even faster, I guess. But I guess it's the theoretical peak performance is 124.5 petaflops, which is, I guess, the first time that a system's exceeded 100 petaflops.
That's big.
What are the numbers?
124.5 petaflops. That's its theoretical peak performance.
That's the theoretical. So yeah. It's not tested then, apparently.
Well, they're running some workloads on it. And it's actually, you know, it's funny. The interesting thing that, and you guys were on the show a couple shows ago when I did talk about this, but one of the workloads, the first thing they listed about what they're running on this is they're running modelings of advanced manufacturing processes. And I talked about a couple weeks ago how China was really had a huge emphasis on process innovation. And how that's going to be their huge differentiator within the global marketplace. And, you know, companies like Apple really need to pay attention to this. And I thought that was interesting. That was the very first thing that they decided to the list as running on the system is advanced manufacturing models.
After breaking down security barriers.
Yeah, exactly. After crunching away on the NSA's DBase, then they're running manufacturing models.
The side story here, though, and you mentioned it, is, you know, 100% built in China, which because there are no mainstream brand U.S. processors in there, right? There was last year some sort of order, judicial, legal situation that prohibited China from using U.S. chips, specifically from Intel, were not permitted to be sold to China for these types of reasons, supercomputer projects. So they had to basically create their own. And going back on the story that's linked to the story we're talking about, it really comes down to nuclear emulation, right? So apparently, since 1992, the U.S. is emulating nuclear explosion simulation with supercomputers. It's a lot more practical than actually, you know, using a weapon of such. But that
They ran out of atolls to blow up. And
wait,
sink,
is Matthew Broderick a part of this project?
He was not the author, no. But I thought that side story was very interesting. And you know, China's a huge force. They've got raw materials, they've got rare earth goods, they've got labor to do anything, but they do have an opportunity for improved supply chain, logistics, advanced manufacturing stuff. That is absolutely an opportunity there. So not surprising that would be the first use case.
I'm just glad to hear they're not applying it to beer brewing yet, because, you know, what if they took over the worldwide beer market?
Oh, you should have. Did I ever tell you the story of the time I flew China Airlines and asked for a beer?
Please do.
Okay, so, well, actually, China Airlines, and for those that don't know, is the one that's based in Taiwan. Okay, so that's actually the Republic of China, not the People's DPR, the mainland China. Okay, so it's a different China. But anyways, funny story. I get on the plane and I said, well, what beers do you have? And they're like, well, we have Heineken and Taiwan beer. And I'm like, oh, I'll take the Taiwan beer. What's its name? And she goes, Taiwan beer. I'm like, no, what is it called? Oh, it's Taiwan beer. She gives me the can. What's it called? It's called Taiwan beer. That's its name.
See, we need a beer that's called American beer.
U.S. beer.
I think we just did America beer. Didn't Anheuser-Busch, now that they're owned by a foreign company,
the Guinness try to
rebrand themselves?
Oh, yeah, the Guinness American.
They try to rebrand themselves as America.
Guinness did one, yeah. The American Blonde or something like that. That's the first thing they make.
Well, you know what? If it's anything like that Hop House 13 that I had in Ireland last week, hey, that's a beer. I really like that. It's an ale, not a lager.
I'm all about the ales.
Yeah, so it was.
Don't get me started.
Or maybe it was the lager. I don't know.
Well, hey, what's wrong with stouts? I mean, if you're in Ireland, you got to do a little stout drinking.
Brother doesn't like it, man. Just saying.
You know, I didn't it at the actual brewery in Dublin. When I had a Guinness at the brewery, my mind, it knocked my head back. I'm like, this is what everybody's talking about.
It was better, for sure.
Isn't that the coolest place, though? It's like Disneyland.
It had outstanding entertainment production quality. It was one of the best I've ever done, the Dublin Guinness experience. But Hop House 13 is the lager. Sorry, got it backwards. That was pretty good. That's a Guinness brand I didn't even know. I really like it.
Dang.
Boom, boom.
Gotta go
get
find
your Taiwan
it.
Beer.
So we've all been to the Guinness storehouse.
Mm.
We're going to have to, like, cut our fingers or something and mix
that
blood then, too.
St. James Gate?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Good place. The only thing, there was no entertainment when I was there. It was just a bunch of other bohemian backpackers.
No, the entertainment is up on the top when they're drinking a little bit more than their free pass permits. That's what I saw. Yeah.
Yeah, I found out you could tear your ticket in a bunch of pieces and give them each piece, and they'll give you a beer for every piece of your ticket.
You tell me that after I get back.
Yeah, see.
Yeah, you guys should have been recording together before. Hey, one last tech news thing, and that has to do with this iOS app. Called ICEA. Apparently, this app was made to help spot migrants in the Mediterranean Sea, and they had some partnership with a migrant offshore aid station (MOAS), and it's supposed to spot people adrift at sea. Apparently, it never worked. There was no spotting, and so it showed on the screen. It apparently showed migrants adrift in the ocean. But they were from Google Maps images from weeks, months, whatever ago, and it wasn't even close to real time.
That's an API versioning problem.
is that an API versioning problem?
Yeah.
Or is this just a total freaking hoax?
It's bad taste, right? There's plenty of bad apps out there, like the night vision goggle app. It doesn't work on any phone, okay? But it's one of those things that this one is one that goes into the category of bad taste, right? Because you think that you're helping out with a humanitarian thing. It could be an app of ill repute that might be scraping things from a phone. But it also might be one of those things that is just an idea to test the market for something. One of the things that happens, believe it or not, is bull crap.
You can say worse than that.
Okay. Bullcrap apps sometimes are made as a low cost, low risk test to see if there's interest for something. Everything from custom made makeup to, you know, delivery of you know, recyclables the other way so that you can go through them, whatever. People make bizarre things just to see if there's an interest for it. It's a way to see if there's a market for something like this.
Oh, yeah. There's whole firms that do this whole makeup. So, they'll do everything from creating yourselves a false web presence to false Twitter app and do Yelp reviews for you up to creating fake apps that don't actually do anything but to see how many people actually download the app. But I think it's a critical part of, you know, of good strategies too. I think like the Google innovation team where they kind of parachute in and, you know, and do this whiteboarding and, you know, and create, you know, help people do new products. There was a good episode in the startup podcast where they talk about how, you know, these guys parachuted and helped the guy, you know, with his, sort of with Gimlet Media. And they just create something that kind of looks like it would actually work, but it doesn't actually work. Mm-hmm. And so it's not even an MVP. It's this sort of minimum viable marketing product, that you would actually push out and see what the response is. But this, you know, example here just looks like vaporware.
Or the other half is maybe they're testing a way an API works and they just made this app that maybe a lot of people would download just to test an app on scale to hit some sort of API. Like, there's a whole bunch of new APIs coming out. Like, Azure has a face API, face recognition, right? How do you test that? You know, how do you make – I'm not saying that type of thing happened, but if you were a coder of something else, maybe something like this could be used to test the way your code would tip over or not. Who knows what is actually going on, but this is just one of millions of craplications available in your app store.
Yeah, and I think the story here is that just it was under the guise of being a humanitarian effort, so all these good-intentioned people were downloading it, thinking that it was actually going to help when, in fact, it was just absolutely nothing behind it.
Yeah, the bad taste – on the good thing is what made it suck extra.
Yeah, and then the next real one that comes along, no one's going to believe.
And the name of the company that developed it was the Gray Group. Gray? I mean, really?
That sounds like from X-Files, or maybe The Fringe.
You know, maybe that's what they do. They do all this gray stuff. Let's move on to business news from that. That actually was business news more than tech, because they didn't develop any tech. So Oracle posted numbers, and depending on who you talk to, they were good or bad. Anybody look at them?
Yeah, I mean, they're good for, you know, Larry's doing just fine. So when people talk about, you know, oh, you know, they're down this percent of that percent, or, you know, their hardware business is tanking. It's like when you go from, like, you know, 5 billion to 4.6 billion, that's not really the definition of tanking. And I thought it was interesting that in the article too, that the headline talks about, you know, don't buy their kit. And they're, you know, they're moving away from on-prem, but it wasn't until the very end where you see hardware revenues, we're down 10%, you know, for the year. And that was the whole sort of, you know, thrust, I guess, of the article, is that, you know, they're moving to cloud. And Larry, he is gunning for Mark Benioff like hardcore. He's like, you know, I'm going to beat Mark on every Salesforce, you know, run rate projection that you've got.
Yeah, so they've got great cloud numbers, but when you start at zero, it's great. You know, it's easy to have big multiples. Are they actually making a dent anywhere, or is it just bullshit?
Well, obviously there was a whole host of numbers that were put up that were just, you know, smoke and mirrors. And they still haven't, you know, addressed a lot of the pointed questions that the press, you know, and other investors put at them, which is one of the reasons why they're getting sued. So, yes, there is a bunch of BS there when it comes to their numbers, but also there is definitely some real revenue there. There is actually a product, and there is actually revenue. What that is just it's really opaque. I mean, to like the Street, I think, which is, you know, and Jim Cramer tweeted out, I think very recently, that that Salesforce actually, you know, actually produces a lot more transparent numbers than any of these other cloud vendors, including AWS.
Well, the one thing that I look at this article, the quarter, which is the most recent data, which Oracle's year, by the way, ends on May 30th, kind of interesting. But anyways, for that fourth quarter, which would have been the calendar Q2, their cloud revenues were up 49%, just under $860 million, but that 49% growth. Now, if you think about all of the money that is Oracle, which is a lot, anything that is like single digit up or down, pretty palatable, normal, right? But when you start talking about double digit up, I don't know if anything on this scale from a big company has come up so strong, with the exception of maybe like Cisco and their UCS, you know, recently that come out of nowhere and drop some serious coin. I think on one of the other episodes, I kind of said, hey, I wouldn't be surprised if Oracle would be the dark horse cloud for that number 3, number 4 option.
Oh, you just called it, Rick. Oracle is now the dark horse cloud.
Yeah.
But they did. I mean, one of the articles did mention that they were seeing better growth numbers than Workday and Salesforce for out of Oracle and the cloud. Which I still feel like the jury's out on that.
I don't believe it. But yeah, we should use that acronym, the Oracle DHC.
The DHC.
Maybe I could go make oracle.dhc as a domain.
Yeah. Well, if Rick disappears from the recording for a little bit, we know what he's doing. He's at GoDaddy. Monday, I guess that was yesterday, it was announced that Dell was selling off its enterprise software business. That news was, you know, just completely covered up by what was going on at DockerCon.
I was really shocked.
I'm not.
Because Dell had a software business?
Well, forget that point, but I'm not shocked.
Why weren't you shocked?
Well, Rick? EMC have a very strong software portfolio for a lot of this stuff, but not all. And that's the little twist. Like, SonicWall. I thought they might keep that, but maybe not. But apparently not. Anyways, the fact that there's a lot of software overlap with what EMC have, that's why I'm not surprised.
I'm not surprised that they pulled this off. And I was privy to a few pieces of reorganization in Dell during a couple different stints working with them. But based on sort of like my experience with that piece, it seems like they're really shifting their focus. And I think this is a smart move based on the EMC merger and their focus even before that came to fruition. I don't see why they were even putting as much money as they were into their software piece. I think their strategic focus should be elsewhere, and I think this is the right thing to do.
Yeah, I don't know how much they were putting into software. It's not clear that they were. And it's too bad Gabe isn't on it, because I know he would be going nuts over the fact that the sale was made to Francisco Partners and Elliott Management, you know, the hedge fund company that wanted to break up EMC. He tweeted about it yesterday. He said, so Elliot goes into EMC, you know, pressures to break up the company. They get the sell to Dell, and now they're buying parts of Dell. I mean, what is that?
Yeah, a bunch of lawyers somewhere making a whole bunch of money off of all of this.
Hey, that's a long road, but a small world, friends. I'll tell you that.
There probably are a small number of lawyers making a bunch of money. And I would say that Dell's probably not making that much money on this. I mean, you know, you would like to sell your assets to somebody in the market, you know, that can leverage them and turn them into a product. But you know that the guys running the equity firms, they don't buy this stuff for top dollar. They buy it at rock bottom prices.
And their goal is to clean it up and sell it. That's the thing. They're a holding, a transfer. They're in the business of selling business, in my opinion. Okay, because I used to work with one way back in the day, and that's what they did. They'd pick them up when things weren't quite right or faltering, no clear vision strategy, get the business part right, so that you know the book of business is good, and improve what needs to be improved to make it more attractive on the sale. Now, the other half of it is at the highest level, I think that this is just changing one's mind. What I mean by that is, I don't know, 5 years ago, when did Dell Software start to kind of go on a buying spree? Was it about then?
I think so.
But things have changed, and they've changed their mind. They don't want that. So I think at the highest level, it's just kind of undoing that initiative.
Oops, redo.
See, there's a show called like Flip This House. Why isn't there a show called like Flip This Startup or Flip This Company?
Flip This Business Unit.
Flip This Business. Flip This BU.
Yeah, like Flip Cameras. Like Cisco bought Flip Cameras and decided to plow it under.
Yeah. Ah, Flip Camera. I still got my Flip Camera. I think it's in the bottom drawer of my desk.
Yeah, the
somewhere.
Batteries still kind of work. They're still pretty good.
They're good.
Yeah.
All right.
If you don't have a GoPro, it's great to just throw that off a building.
All right. So you guys saw the article about mayors around the world are trying to solve the problem of Airbnb and Uber in their cities. What's going on is, you know, cities in Europe, Asia, United States, you know, it's like, how do we deal with this new kind of service that's out there, as opposed to, you know, the negotiations we've done with hotels and taxis and the regulations we've had for years. And so these mayors are now trying to band together to create a strategy to deal with Uber and Airbnb and others. Any thoughts on this?
Oh, yeah. It's not a strategy to remove them. Let's be very clear on that. It's a strategy to make it work with all interests, which is going to be difficult. My personal opinion is that the innovation that's come from Airbnb and Uber is way faster than what municipalities, what airports, and all that can do. They want to get it right. They want to make sure that everything is the best it can be. And it could be a simple, you know what, I'd love to see an agenda of an Uber pickup lane at airport infrastructure designs, because we don't have that in most airports. You know, it's all tacky. You got to go into short-term parking. You got to jump out in the middle of the lane or.
See, I was just at Vegas and there was actually an Uber pickup spot at my hotel. I thought that was just fantastic.
Well, like, great. See, but that's not consistent. Right. There's no, like, it's pretty easy to find a taxi stand about anywhere, whatever it is. It's just, they're going to get it right. And I think it's a great idea because they're going to, maybe this is the first like municipal union of sorts. You know, it almost feels like a union battle between two sides, but I kind of think this is interesting. And I just hope that the answer isn't no. I hope it's yes. And, you know, can't we all just get along? But I do think what's probably going to happen is price will go up.
Of Uber of and Airbnb.
Yeah, things like that. Because like
the sharing services will become more expensive.
I think so. But you know what? I've switched almost 100% of my work transportation, ground transportation, to Uber. I'd go so far as to say it's anywhere from 50% to 33% cheaper. I've looked at my numbers worldwide.
I see that.
But that's because there's some things they're not paying. And, you know, if there's a tax for using the airport, then I think commercial vehicles should pay it.
I think it might go up marginally. But, you know, there was a really cool book that came out. It was called The Sharing Economy. Arun Sundararajan. I can't pronounce his last
Timmerman.
Name. But he brought up a really great point where he talked about a lot of these other technologies like the internet, like the World Wide Web, that if municipalities and other government entities had actually embraced them instead of trying to fight them, then we'd have much better regulations, much more more normalized relationships with these pieces of technology and the law than we do now. So I think if the mayors, indeed, as you said, Rick, they are banding together to make a common sense approach and come up with a strategy that actually works for all parties, then they would be actually sidestepping the mistake that this book talks about happening again and again, and you might actually have something that makes sense where people aren't have like, let's say, for example, somebody who has an Airbnb property right next to them, they actually have a government entity that has a normalized relationship with Airbnb that they can make complaints to. There are specific codes they have to adhere to with regards to noise level, et cetera. And I know some of the municipalities have put that in place, and Airbnb has policies. But the fact that if you have these agencies actually working together, these mayors working together, to actually create something that would be a cohesive and, like you said, consistent, that makes sense, I think is a step in the right direction, not just in these components of the sharing economy, but overall. And if other people would lead by that example, I think we'd have a much, much better experience worldwide.
So do you think this is a political cop-out where these mayors are saying, well, we can go along with this program because everybody else is doing it, we're going to do it too. Meanwhile, you know, all the taxi drivers, the hotel operators in their cities are all going crazy and, you know, threatening to, you know, boycott and do all this stuff. They can point to everybody else to try to take the heat off them?
No. I think it's action based on pressure. I think locally there's pressure from, you know.
Oh, sure there is.
You know, and it's kind of funny how, you know, there are some places, like when I was in South Africa, the transportation situation is very interesting there. And if the taxi driver pool are not happy, that city shuts down to a halt. It's right. And Uber can't even fix that. So there are, you know, there are literally places in the world where transportation groups have incredible, you know, connections and influence to the right place. And I think one angle of it, this is going to be action. And this is, you know, just a plan to start thinking about a plan. This isn't really the plan. So the thing is, they have to come together and really identify, well, what's the goal? What's going on? What are you having as challenges? They're going to have to figure all that out. It shouldn't take too long. But the goal and getting it into place, I don't think it's a cop-out. You know, political preferences aside, you know, it'd be really encouraging and refreshing if there would be a real positive piece of action out of something like this.
I don't know. I think that every single one of these mayors has probably 7 to 8 things that should be higher priority than this.
Yeah, there's that flip side of that article where it's like, okay, this is what they're spending their cycles on, working with Uber and Airbnb. And for some people, they're, you know, they'll raise their hand and say it's about time. But other people, you know, that are looking at more pressing issues could look at this and say, wow, this is just, I think it was to your point, Mark, and to Rick, that this is a very high visibility issue And that's why they're actually putting cycles into it. Whereas, you know, the actual results of these, you know, will definitely have a positive impact. But there's a lot of other
fair point. You know, if you look at, I don't know municipality structure well, but whatever group's in charge of transportation or whatever group's in charge of public welfare, everything's important in those situations. They're all just important differently. When it comes to the mayor or some other type of figurehead being involved, I think that that's just that's a PR move, personally. You know, you don't want the director of...
That makes sense to me.
You know, they're all important. You can't pick anything that's more important. And it's also, I'd hope, that something like human welfare departments have more people than a transportation department. It might not always be the case, but that's a whole separate problem. This is just another thing that everybody can relate to.
Hey, so another, switching gears completely here, another article that showed up in Bloomberg today was just talking about large corporate acquirers, companies like Google, Facebook, HPE, and whatnot, are sitting on the sidelines and not really looking to cherry pick startups that are coming up. They're waiting for the valuations of these startups to be depressed before they buy them. You know, you look at Microsoft's acquisition of LinkedIn last week, right? LinkedIn had come quite a ways down before Microsoft made a move on it. And the philosophy is now that everybody's doing that. That even though LinkedIn sold for a whopping $26 billion, it was still down from where it had been. Or, you know, for Microsoft to buy it, it was still a relative bargain compared to the price that it had been 4 months previously. So that's now part of the ecosystem for anybody that wants to create a startup, go to work in a startup, invest in a startup, whatever. There are fewer exits. The IPO market's crummy, and people are going to play you down. And Dean, you work at Druva, and that's a startup. I mean, so this could directly affect you. Any thoughts on this?
Well, I think what we're looking at is actually more of a rotation, because people talk about this being a bubble or waiting for, you know, these unicorns valuations to go down. And what people are actually doing is they're actually looking at companies and valuating them differently. And I'll hear this from anywhere from you know, Mark Andreessen talking about it, you know, and Andreessen Horowitz to the Forbes article, where people are now looking at not just this potential ramp up of value based on, you know, potential number of users or in 90s style eyeballs per page kind of a framework, but they're actually looking for companies that actually have real sales strategies, real pipelines, real ways to actually get to revenue generation. And I think that Twitter was probably a big force in changing people's mindsets, because a lot of people had this feeling like, well, I have to get on this train, because it's moving, and just because I don't understand it doesn't mean I shouldn't get on it. And then all of a sudden we're realizing, well, okay, Twitter's struggling to monetize a lot of the value that it's created. You can create value, but monetizing is a very, very different thing. And so, for example, you know, the company that I work at, you know, we're in a position where we have a very real sales pipeline. We have very real, very large customers, you know, paying us very real dollars. And I think there's a rotation into companies like that away from these unicorns that everyone sort of jumped onto the train for and then realized they got on this train like, you know, hey, I didn't understand what I was getting on. Now I realize, okay, maybe these aren't real. And more of them are failing, and more of them are doing down rounds. And people like, you know, their entities like Google are, as the article say, they're sitting on their hands and waiting for valuations to go down.
So it's really interesting, right? You look at a company like Nutanix, you know, planning to have an IPO, it just took a debt financing. You know, what's going to happen to them? Do you think, you know, I'm sure in Dheeraj's mind, they thought that they were just going to exit somewhere near the top. But now you look, if acquirers are actually saying, you know what, we're going to play chicken with everybody else, we're going to see how low this can go. That's a very scary proposition.
I'd agree with that. I also personally think this is a really rough time to try to work market money. Now, I'm not an economist, don't get me wrong, but one thing I do know is that the global the U.S. economy, which in some ways is a pulse of the global economy, takes a weird dip every 8 years. And we're getting ready to start that this fall around presidential elections. You get a little quiet, you get a little timid, don't know what's going to happen. And this year in particular, it might be a little bit more such. I just think this is a cycle, and when everything's okay, the money will start flowing. And one of the ways that in the IT field you can see this is when you see people, bloggers, influencers, just people you know, taking jobs with startups. That means they've got money to hire people, right? I don't know too many people changing jobs right now.
Well, hey,
There's still a lot of money out there.
I get it, but there's not a lot of easy money out there.
We always think the decision is make versus buy. Maybe we can add a third one. Make, buy, wait. Yeah. And finally, our last item for the day is Twitter is making an investment in SoundCloud. A couple questions about that. You know, why SoundCloud and where's the money coming from for that?
Yeah, I looked at that and I thought it was really sort of a dipping the toe in versus because they were going to, you know, they were going to buy them a year ago and they walked away. And now they're just doing a strategic investment. I don't know where that money's coming from.
How much is the investment you need?
$70 million.
$70 million. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, not chump change.
No.
Well, I think, you know, interesting, right? The social media spaces, I think they have an incredible challenge to diversify and add more services. I'll skip Facebook because I think Facebook and Instagram are doing just fine. But, yeah. You know, like I use Foursquare or Swarm as it is now, like every day. But I'm pretty sure I'm like one of the only people. I go places checking twice a mayor, so something's not right. I don't know if people are using all.
Well, now I know how to find you. I'll just sign up for Foursquare.
Oh yeah, actually, I do it just so my wife knows what I'm up to. But anyways, the funny thing where I'm getting with that is Twitter, which I use a lot. I love it. Don't get me wrong. They've got a need to kind of close the ecosystem a little bit, and what I mean by that is you got to use their app. I think I don't use the Twitter app except on my Surface RT, but generally, I use the web page. I use Hootsuite. I use a couple different Tweetcaster. I use a lot of different apps. But the thing is, if I had something that would differentiate it and bring it back to the Twitter app, that would be good, right? If I had a service I like SoundCloud, which I don't use. I use Pandora. But honestly, it doesn't work out of the country that much. So maybe if that would be fixed, that would be a little bit more awesome for me. That would do something that would maybe put me back a little bit closer to their brand rather than just kind of a tag along users. So I think it's interesting, and I think all the social media brands have to do something to kind of differentiate themselves. And my little crack pipe projection is that maybe they're going to get into some sort of, Snapchat type of sharing situation. That's my crack pipe idea.
I'm not seeing what Twitter is doing with SoundCloud. I mean, I love SoundCloud. I love it. And I don't see the integration with the Twitter platform. I don't really see Twitter as knowing what it is and what it wants to be right now. I see it very confident in projecting its current strategy to shareholders on the quarterly earnings conference calls. But beyond that, I don't see people staying with Twitter enough to actually really get embedded within the code base and adding the kind of value that you need when, you know, engineers and senior engineers, you know, stay with the company for a long time. I feel like the churn is a little bit too high there. And I feel like the leadership really hasn't got its arms around what the company needs to be from a good, successful, non-Wall Street strategy perspective.
Well, guys, this was a lot of fun. I think it's time to call it quits. Episode 91 of In Tech We Trust. Remember, listeners, try to check out Nigel's podcast this week from DockerCon. He made one yesterday. I think he's got another one yet coming, so that'll be up there in addition to this. Check us out. If you've got something to say, please find us on Twitter at In Tech We Trust. Thanks for listening.